It made perfect sense then when the members of the Society for the Diffusion of Useful Knowledge were looking for someone who could translate Laplace's multi-volumed celestial mechanics into English that they approached Somerville. The challenge was formidable. How could she be loyal to what Laplace had technically achieved and still communicate to the average educated English reader? What she ended up doing was to provide more than a translation. It was a translation with commentary. She completed the task in 1831 in a four-volume work, which included a preliminary dissertation that located Laplace's achievement within the history of Newtonian astronomy. Her accomplishment was universally praised for making Laplace accessible, and it certainly established Somerville's authority as a scientific figure in Victorian Britain. When you look at her work, I mean in particular her commentary and the preliminary discourse, you catch a glimpse of Somerville's understanding of the meaning of physical science. Laplace's achievement was the occasion for her to celebrate natural science as a support for basic Victorian values. Somerville's understanding of the cosmos Laplace had mathematically described indicated clearly that it hadn't happened by accident. It must have been designed. She saw science as an ennobling activity that also promoted humility. Yes, the world was stable and enduring, as Laplace had shown, and science was a heroic and progressive social enterprise. This was precisely the kind of exposure that helped bring attention to natural science among the public, just as did the founding of the British Association in the same year Somerville's translation came out. So, Laplace's name was well known in Britain by the 1840s. Both his nebular hypothesis and his more technical astronomical analysis. As far as the nebular hypothesis was concerned, it was more controversial than anything in the technical volumes. I think you can see why. The nebular hypothesis was what we might call in-your-face deism. It forced the issue. It was saying that you didn't need God to explain how the solar system came to be. No more could you be content with the, in the beginning God created the heavens and earth. That wouldn't fly according to the great astronomer Laplace. In the beginning, there was a rotating, slowly rotating solar nebulous fluid. So you can see why the nebular hypothesis enjoyed both supporters and detractors in the first half of the century. In Britain, two popular authors championed the nebular hypothesis. You'll recall that Laplace's scheme was given a central place in the Vestiges of the Natural History of Creation of 1844. For the content of the nebular theory, Chambers hadn't had to rely directly on Laplace himself. Just as Laplace's technical work was made available by Somerville, Laplace's nebular hypothesis had been explained to English readers by the British astronomer John Nicol, who had championed the theory in his popular astronomical writings. And Nicol was a friend of Chambers. When you looked into what Nicol had to say, you could see quickly where he stood. Nicol wanted you to believe that everybody who was anybody acknowledged the truth of the nebular hypothesis of the great Laplace. In fact, he maintained that the great truths in astronomy were being discussed in almost every popular periodical as if they had already become common knowledge. Well, that wasn't quite the way it was. The nebular theory was not, of course, without its detractors. Many people saw it as tantamount to atheism, since it replaced God as creator with natural law. Note again how hard it was for deists to avoid the charge of atheism. They claimed that they were enhancing the glory of God by showing how great God was when he imposed laws on nature. But this tactic never seemed to work. In the eyes of many, the remote God of deism was equivalent to no real God at all. So the nebular hypothesis had opponents because of the religious implications it appeared to carry. But there were also those who disagreed with the content of the theory itself. Some argued, for example, that the supposed primal fluid that made up nebulae was not really a fluid at all. Galileo had exposed his nebula to be individual stars, once you had a telescope that could reveal them. Who's to say that Laplace's allegedly nebulous fluid wasn't really made up of stars, too? Those who held this view of things found no comfort in the latest attempts to resolve nebulae into stars with the telescopes of the early 19th century. Nobody had been able to show that the large nebulae that were known were made up of stars. One of the nebulae that had attracted a lot of attention, for example, was the Great Nebula in the constellation Orion. It was massive, it was easily seen, and it had an irregular shape. And here came the rub. When you used even William Herschel's famous telescopes to look at it, you couldn't see any signs of resolvability. So the debates raged.